Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams, whew,
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Super Sale and get 40% off paints and stains September 19th through the 24th. With prices starting at $29.39, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Welcome to How to Fix It. I'm John Avalon, author, columnist, historian. This podcast is focused on trying to find solutions to the problems we face, not just fixating on the problems themselves. And one of the great divides in American politics and history historically, of course, is race. The idea of liberalism is focusing on individual rights, transcending that group identity. But Democrats have a brand perception problem at the very least. On embracing identity politics, which has been weaponized. And now we see this pendulum swing. So the question is, how do Democrats ditch identity politics and embrace a more consistent liberalism that actually is inclusive? What are the mistakes that have been made? And what are actually the steps we can take to correct that, to reflect the essential diversity of America without fixating on those differences in a way that's divisive? One of the best thinkers about that is Thomas Chatterton Williams. He's a contributing writer at The Atlantic, a professor at Bard College. He's author of several books and a visiting scholar at AEI. Thomas Chatterton Williams, welcome to How to Fix It.
First of all, thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
You too, man.
Yeah, I think a lot of what actually we're talking about when we talk about identity politics and the ways in which the left can alienate the types of non-white voters who broke more for Trump this time than they've broken for a Republican candidate since going back to Nixon. I think what we're talking about here often is a kind of linguistic dominance or language games or a way of talking about identity, not just race, but gender, sexuality, what have you, that requires a kind of education that functions as a gatekeeping mechanism. And so it really alienates people who don't belong to the class that speaks this way or conceives of themselves and others this way. So it's a messaging problem, first and foremost, if you're talking about on a practical level from what Democrats can do. I think that you can, you know, embrace a liberalism that sees the individual as fundamentally valuable and sovereign, but also wants to raise the floor of dignity to such a level that it enables people from all walks of life and backgrounds to participate in the American dream. A lot of Democratic policies and energy already work that way, but this kind of messaging system really, really muddies the ability of regular working people to be able to see that.
Democrats have, I think, a moral obligation. America has historically stood, however imperfectly, for the project of forming a more perfect union towards a diverse liberal democracy. And in any fair reading of American history, probably world history, there's a deep resistance to multiracial democracy. And yet, Trump did make gains with communities of color, so-called, in the last election, despite embracing a lot of sort of, you know, white identity politics, it seems to me. So how do you understand that? And when you're talking to Democratic constituencies about the need to change?
There is a slightly different energy surrounding Trump 2.0 and the first Trump run. And there is that core white identity politics around his candidacy and his person and his persona. But there is also a kind of style and mood that invites people in from various backgrounds if they reject a kind of elite status signaling and sensibility. And it can actually, in a weird way, be inclusive. So I actually see the white identity politics as being much more activated when he was breaking into the scene than once he became a known commodity, if that makes sense.
That's interesting. So there is this paradoxical that MAGA seems inclusive and welcoming, whereas there's the sense, fair or not, that a lot of the identity politics signaling was exclusive, right? I mean, this is the the sense that people were sort of tiptoeing around for fear of offending. There was the constant specter of being sort of brought to HR. And again, these things do not pale in comparison to the weight of historical racism, for sure. And this is one of the lines you walk. You know, a lot of what your writing is about is rejecting the binary choice in America's particularly tortured history with race. You're either black or white. But also politically, some folks try to push you to the right, and you've resisted that, saying, you know, no, I'm trying to stand up to extremes on both sides, to which I say amen.
It's a weird and lonely place because, you know very well, you don't get love from the left that you're critiquing. But if you don't turn that corner and become yourself right wing, then you don't get much love there consistently either. So you're both critiquing and being critiqued by both extremes. But I think that there's this kind of exhausted middle in American culture and politics that really does not like the illiberalism that that gets activated and energized on the progressive left or on the kind of real reactionary MAGA right, and is just hoping for, you know, sane political discourse, compromise, a patriotism that's healthy. And that can be inclusive. I really believe those voters and those citizens are out there. But the way our politics rewards breaking to the extremes is really unhealthy for that. And, you know, that's why I think it's so important on the left for the kind of progressive activist wing not to create enemies out of centrists and liberals and even center right, you know, moderate Republicans that could be reached, because they're also put off by the extremism of MAGA. I think it's really important to make those coalitions and alliances that don't resort to a purity politics. But that's what we've been going through for the past 10 or more years on the left, is a kind of, you mentioned HR. There's a culture of fear where you can say the wrong thing and you can be expelled and you can be punished. And that's no way to build the kind of coalition that we need to oppose what Trump's been able to do with a kind of non-elites or non-educated or non-status signaling multicultural slight majority on the right.
I think that's so well said. And again, it's almost laying down these broader markers. We have illiberalism on the far left and the far right. And the alternative is something that's truly inclusive, something that does embrace diverse liberal democracy, but it requires focusing on what unites us, not what divides us, and treating everyone as an individual first. And that's an elusive thing in our history. And nonetheless, if we lose that North Star, we start losing people and being open to accusations of hypocrisy, frankly, right?
Oh, absolutely. It's so difficult in American politics, especially now, to avoid a kind of susceptibility to hypocrisy, because, you know, there are such outrages that one can point to, and it feels like principle is not expedient. So defending free speech feels like a lost cause or a fool's errand when you know that the person or the party that you're fighting, as soon as they get in power, will also not uphold principles of free speech. But once you stop upholding the process, once you don't believe in the process, then what we're actually seeing is that the right comes to power. I think it's infinitely worse. I want to be clear about that. I think what's going on with Trump and his coalition is infinitely worse than what had preceded it. But everything that they do that's an abuse, an egregious abuse, they can point to some type of precedent, however tenuous, and say, well, they did this here, and we are riddled with precedents for them to point to of not actually being committed to free speech, or, you know, of scapegoating, punishing, canceling. All that stuff really did happen. Gaslighting, astroturfing, you know, just denying the basic reality that people can see with their eyes and telling them that they're racist or bigots if they mention it. All that stuff happened. So we give them a sword to pick up and wield against us.
And that opens the door to the whataboutism game that creates sort of a mythic moral equivalence while democracy is being run down.
Exactly.
And what's particularly galling in your most recent piece, The Atlantic, is actually how a lot of the rallying cry of defending free speech has been revealed to be, as it always was to me, almost self-evidently, complete partisan BS. You talk about the rise of a woke right in reaction to a woke left. So explain.
Well, so wokeness is a concept that is a word that I don't love, but it is sticky, and it describes something in our politics that is real and that was very prevalent on the left. It's this idea that, you know, first and foremost, reality can be sorted along the lines of oppressors and oppressed, and that there's a status in being a victim, and that also that creates a kind of state of exception where normal liberal values and procedures can be discarded because this power imbalance must be rectified. And so you identify your victim group, you take the righteousness of fighting against the systemic oppression, and then you do away with, you know, the basic norms of liberalism and pursuing your ends. And, you know, what we saw on the left, I want to be clear, and it peaked and culminated in the summer of 2020 and 2021. Those were mad times. The left really, it was ascendant in the mainstream culture and in the important institutions, the universities, the media. And there was an abuse of this kind of way of seeing things and a desire to punish and rectify inequalities. What we got in replacing that was not a kind of sober conservatism that moved the needle back to the middle and said, enough excess, let's break this fever. We got just the distorted mirror image of that impulse to, and the new victim class saw themselves as the people who, you know, that institutional left was oppressing and seeks revenge now and seeks by any means necessary to make themselves whole. And so it's this kind of pendulum swing between illiberalisms, and we have to find a way to get that needle back to the middle. And I think that's the work of Democrats, certainly, but it's the work of, you know, there's a lot of center-right allies, I think, that could be reachable if we had a plausible way of presenting a positive vision and not just reacting all the time to the excesses of the far right or far left.
So let's talk about the language about that, as well as the policies and the strategy. I want to concretize this as much as possible. You know,
I've been talking quite abstractly.
No. We both have, but this is one of the challenges in rebuilding a vital center, in rebuilding not an exhausted middle. I never, mm-hmm. you know, but an energized middle that actually reflects the vast majority of the American people. That an embrace of the essential diversity of our country and our history, but with grace. Mm-hmm. Wokeness, as you said, is sticky, mm-hmm. right? A lot of these terms are sticky, and there has been a failure to, I think, galvanize the moderate majority and turn it into a movement. What are the kind of language that you like around this sort of transcendence of tribalism and an embrace of Americanism?
Yeah, well, you know, I think first and foremost, somehow we have to find a way of talking to each other as individuals and to look for ways to de-emphasize the kind of language that that prioritizes or foregrounds identity. That's really difficult to do, but we need leaders that speak in this way that don't, you know, one of the problems of the Democrats, going back to Clinton's defeat against Trump in 2016, was that they have a kind of fragmented messaging system. They have, I believe Mark Lilla pointed out in the Once and Future Liberal, his book, kind of trying to do a to examine the loss that Clinton suffered. There were 17 different messages for 17 different groups that they'd identified on the Democratic, the DNC yeah. website. But the Republicans had just a single policy platform. You might dislike it. It might be inadequate, but that they had a message, and that was for anybody who chose to buy into it. And I think first and foremost, the Democrats need to start doing that, not breaking people down into these kind of abstract categories, but really deal with real individuals. And that means sometimes recognizing contradictions, recognizing that there is not a Black interest, that actually they can, because these are dynamic groups, there can be contradictory interests. You know, when we were in the height of 2020, it was in the interest of the Black community to abolish the police. But that's not what many working class Black people actually said was in their interest. As individuals,
Never. Yes. Polling wise, it was the opposite. It was white liberals were more likely to back that policy. But anyway, go on.
Exactly. And just like it was very difficult for people to understand in the most recent election how Trump captured so many Latino votes, that was because they were not treating Latinos as individuals who are looking at this country, not through the lens of some pan-Latino identity that transcends borders, but as taxpaying American citizens who want secure borders. And that was something that Democrats were unable to wrap their minds around, because so that those are some practice, just changing the way that we see and interact with potential voters is first and foremost a necessary endeavor.
I think that's so critical. And that's certainly something I saw in my campaign. First of all, the Hispanic community's essential diversity does not allow itself or lend itself. No group does, right? I mean, I wrote a column years ago called The Myth of the White Monolith and how the definition of white has changed over time, you know. But the Hispanic community in particular, I mean, you can't understand the community as a whole because it is not a monolith. There are, right. you know, Hispanic Americans whose family have been in the country for like 300, 400 years, you know, and then there's the diversity right. of every community from Central America with a totally distinct heritage. And so the way, the most effective way to communicate is not by condescending to talk to them as an interest group, but talk about, you know, help you achieve your American dream. They're here hardworking. They want to be safe. They want to be able to, you know, do better for their family. And that's something that unites all of us. And that right. segmentation you discuss on the policy page is one of those canaries in the coal mine of the deeper problem. And I do think people kick back on that. Do you think sometimes folks say, as Trump and the Republicans sort of define diversity as, I think Pete Hegseth says, unity and diversity is the single dumbest slogan we ever came up with, right? There's a lot behind that bumper sticker. But do you think we've passed peak woke, as some people say? Because there are a lot of signs that, first of all, I mean, the people's caricature of the far left doesn't represent virtually anyone in Democratic leadership. So do you think we've passed peak woke?
It really depends where you look and who you talk to. I have been surprised, you know, since the election that there have been a lot of people with cultural capital and who influence arguments, at least online, if not political realities on the ground. Some of those voices, your Jamelle Bouies at the New York Times or people like this have argued a version of real wokeness hasn't been tried yet. So we need to double down. We need to get woker. I think that's clearly not the wise path to proceed down. I don't think what American voters were saying is that you didn't really try to radicalize like our conception of biological sex enough, and so you should just fight that battle harder. Or I don't think that, you know, they thought that, you know, tokenizing people's identities and fulfilling essentially racial quotas hadn't been tried energetically enough, and we have to do that harder. I think what people want is something much more sober. I don't think that most Americans object to diversity in fact, but what they reject to is the idea that there's only a certain kind or certain kinds of diversity that matter and others do not. So a superficial mm-hmm. kind of, you know, skin deep diversity, I don't think even many Black people appear to desire. What we don't ever talk about is that there is great strength in, you know, intellectual diversity and viewpoint diversity, things like this that actually should totally be cultivated, agree. Especially in our military and places like that. But that cannot ever be reflected just in the epidermis or in one sex organs. You really have to actually know people as people to understand who is bringing what diversity to the table. And I won't keep going, but you know, something Bernie Sanders said that always sticks with me that is very true is that it isn't good enough just to say that we have a billionaire oligarchic ruling class that is demographically aligned. And so you have 13% of billionaires being Black and however many Asian, Latino, women, gay. That's not good enough, actually. You know, we actually need to mean something more than that. And I don't think that Democrats are going to really be able to engage the American public if they don't recognize that people want something that's not skin deep.
And it's also contrary to fairness. And this is something Absolutely. That I think is it needs to be underlined, because if you look at liberal values, right, it's about individual human rights. It's about not being defined as members of group. It also means that, you know, while recognizing the very real history of structural racism, particularly but not exclusively in our country, and everyone should be doing a lot more studying of the Reconstruction era right now. At the same time, it's transcending that. It's the promise. It's the aspiration. It's the goal. And that's one of the things that gets stuck, you know, kind of gets caught around the axle, is that people say on some level, that's not fair. And then yes. it seems illiberal.
Yes. And, you know, polling on this is quite consistent. Black Americans do not consider admissions criteria that only look at race as fair, and they don't want to be in a system that is unfair, even if in certain instances they benefit from it. Often many of them don't even feel they benefit from it. They feel like that's been captured by elites and it doesn't trickle down to them either. And that kind of frustration has found its way to supporting Trump. But I think most Americans really do value fairness. And I don't think that what the Republicans are giving them right now is fair. But at least they talk in a way that says that they care about fairness, or they want to care about the unfairness that they see as having been implemented that all of us can see, actually. There was great unfairness that was very evident. The past 5 years were full of all kinds of unfairness. And one unfairness that is not exactly what you were saying, but I will say this is a version of an unfairness that I think gets people really riled up, is the idea that any objection that you might have to the consensus that you're being told you have to buy into is evidence of poor character, of bigotry, or of transphobia or Islamophobia or things like this, and that you're not allowed to have a good faith disagreement on what type of society we want to live in. That has been, I think, very detrimental.
I strongly agree. And I think back to one of my favorite quotes that Barack Obama put forward, it's that democracy depends on an assumption of goodwill among fellow citizens.
Yes.
And the impulse to expel, to judge people's character and then be judge and jury in sort of a court of public opinion conducted on social media, and sometimes, is not helpful to the larger project, which does require grace. It requires an assumption of goodwill. Let's talk a little bit about that. You were one of the co-authors of sort of a letter that looks quaint today, but was surprisingly controversial at the time. With the fullness of history, it was basically saying that, Donald Trump's a danger to democracy, but be careful of illiberalism on the left. It was signed by, I think, 120 signatories. I wrote about it. In the fullness of time, looking back, what do you think about that backlash and how the document has aged and how people's trajectories have gone? Because that's a decent signifier of those broadly in the center, it seems to me.
Yeah, absolutely. And we were fortunate to have some real leftists like Noam Chomsky and Cornel West and people like this sign it too. We had some conservatives. We didn't have no MAGA people signed it, but we had real conservatives, David Frum, Francis Fukuyama. Anyway, it was a document that was saying, we need to have a culture of maximal tolerance, not censoriousness. And that Donald Trump is a threat to the open society. So we need to really counter that with a commitment to the open society. And I think what has been borne out in the ensuing years, especially, if you look at the campus protests and things like this, where people advocating for Palestine have been repressed in places like Texas, the governor has Governor Abbott has, arrested people and has spoken about speech being an offense that can be punished by the state, spoken quite openly about that. The Trump administration is clearly crossing into that territory. And a lot of us were saying, this is exactly what we were trying to tell you about. You were playing with something that opens the Pandora's box to people saying, well, look, you agree with us on principle, at least. There are some types of speech that that cross the line and that should be expelled, even forcibly expelled and punished. You just don't agree with us on what kind of speech that is. But you already said that the reaction can be understood or accepted in certain cases. And so that was a bad precedent to set, frankly. And also, they look hypocritical and it rings hollow when they ask that they not be. Be treated this way after they were willing to do so in the summer of 2020. So we were arguing for a kind of consistency and a culture of tolerance that I think is fundamental to a democratic society, and that the Trump administration is just riding roughshod over right now.
Negative respect for those democratic norms, but this is the key point, right? Is that you need to apply liberal ideas consistently. right? It's principles above party. We always talk about country over party. I agree in that. But it's principles over party too. And when, once that pendulum starts swinging, you know, we need to recenter that. Or as we are seeing, and we'll continue to see, it'll be at our peril.
A culture where the accusation is the conviction is one that can eventually devour anyone. It doesn't just stay targeted at the people you deem to be obviously the bad people. That fire always escapes the fireplace and starts to run wild, to tear up everything. And we're seeing that now. You know, in the Trump administration, in this new dispensation, the accusation is also the conviction, and that was happening before Trump came back to power, and he partially rode back to power by promising that he would simply redirect that punishment elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. I will be your revenge. I will be your retribution. Yep. I think that's brilliantly said. All right, let's talk about the current state of politics. One of the momentarily strong examples of this is Gavin Newsom, governor of California, possible presidential aspirant, is conducting a podcast. This is one of these things where most people in politics want to be in media, it seems. but at least it's very controversial, some of the guests he's had on. And while I probably would make different decisions on some of those, nonetheless, I think he's actually trying to walk the walk, not just talk the talk, about having difficult conversations across the divide. In one of those conversations, he said that, speaking of fairness, that he didn't feel that the issue of girls' sports, which has been, I think, used to divide and distract, particularly attacks on the trans community, he didn't think that trans youth should be playing on girls' sports teams because he said it wasn't fair. Is that one of those bellwether moments, you think, on an issue which, I mean, when Seth Moulton said the same thing, I mean, some of his staff quit, a member of Congress from Massachusetts, friend of the show. Yeah, so what do you make of that moment going beyond, you know, racial politics into gender politics, which Trump spent $77 million trying to push that message?
Well, I was going to
on broadcast TV.
I don't think that is the hill that Democrats can afford to die on, especially that kind of not trans inclusion, not civil rights, not dignity and respect, but the idea that women's spaces, biological female spaces, are to be fully inclusive of trans athletes or trans prisoners. I don't think that those arguments are necessarily where the American public is giving any indication that it's willing to go to. So I think Newsom is correct. And I think that the autopsy of the Harris campaign was pretty conclusive that, you know, Trump, not just through the lens of white supremacy or white patriarchy or any of that, but like through a multicultural large majority lens, Trump made the point that she's for they, them, and he's for you. And that message resonated. And it seemed like the Democrats have their priorities backward. And that notion of fairness is important. You know, nobody wants to see their daughter not get a fair shake. That's just a fact. And even if you think of politics as just strictly pragmatic, there are just many more people who have daughters or sisters or female relatives that they are feeling protective towards. That is a numerical number. That's just a number that is much greater than the amount of people who are advocating for having a trans daughter play sports with them. So it doesn't work as politics. And I don't think that many Americans feel that it's equivalent to the civil rights movement. So I think it's a bad hill to die on. And Newsom recognizing that, I think, is a measure of where the mainstream sensibility is now.
Who, lest we forget, was a pioneer on same-sex marriage when he was mayor of San Francisco. Yeah. So, I mean, this is someone who's got credibility with that community. For me, it always comes down to, I mean, first of all, kindness is a value we Absolutely. Don't talk about a lot in politics. And when we're talking about certainly trans adults, I try to put everything through the prism of fundamental American values, which I see as liberty, equality, self-determination. And the demonization of that community bothers me deeply because it's unkind.
Absolutely.
But that we should be able to have a nuanced conversation, you know, that just rings true in terms of common sense for folks. And that when you depart from that, they can drive a truck through it.
Yes, that gets back to what we were talking about a bit earlier, the idea that to dissent at all is to reveal that you are fundamentally transphobic, unkind, or that you hate this community. And there's no room for a kind of principled and nuanced good faith disagreement. And, you know, I think that really has to be pulled back.
Where I want to go and really drill down on this before we go is okay. So there are norms of conversation that need to be reinforced. Sometimes these are linguistic, sometimes it's attitudinal. But in terms of the Democratic Party and the vast moderate majority, the vital center, what strategically should Democrats do on this front to sort of ditch identity politics and transcend those restrictions? Understanding that by its nature, you're never getting uniformity, right? It's actually about a broader tolerance. But what would you recommend as a policy prerogative, not just a stylistic issue, to kind of really resonate that these are changes that the Democratic Party is making?
Well, it is only so much policy you can do when you're completely out of power, right?
But you do need to reset the table and offer a new menu.
Yeah, right. I think one way to reset the table would be to publicly disassociate from some of the real activist groups that have kind of taken. I mean, think about how Kamala Harris ended up in that position that Trump was able to exploit and potentially that changed the election. It was an activist segment of the ACLU that was forcing Democratic candidates in 2019, 2020 to be on the record saying that they supported government funded sex changes operations for illegal immigrants in ICE custody. That was actually how the quote arose.
That's asking folks to thread a needle. And you're right. It's a little bit of performative, right? You're on stage and you've got to agree with this highly specific policy position, which, by the way, is not, you know, attitudinally, I think she actually deserves a lot of credit. She actively tried to not focus on identity politics in the course of her campaign, even though among some folks, she was unfairly an avatar of it. But that ad was one of the ways they made it sticky. Yeah. I mean, that's a great example. So that's one thing of just, first of all, either have the courage to say no, right?
Which is what Americans are looking for that in politicians too. Have the courage to stand up to the bullies on your own side and show Americans that you could potentially stand up to the bullies on the other side. Expel or dissociate from the most extreme activist groups within your coalition. I think Democrats have to publicly put some daylight between themselves and some of the excesses of the progressive left. After November, you saw that like AOC on Twitter and Blue Sky, like the pronouns came out of her bio. That is a small gesture, but that means that I think it signaled to a lot of people that she's reevaluating positions, that she's being serious about taking feedback, and that didn't work. That felt like an imposition to a lot of people, rightly or wrongly. People felt that was forcing them into a kind of right think and wrong think, and AOC stepped away from that. So that's a way to start. And then I think if Democrats get a chance to govern again, you know, a lot of what Biden did was actually, you know, it was unfair the way that Trump was able to frame these things. A lot of the policies and things that Biden did on behalf of working Americans, middle class Americans. But some of the things he or his team did that that overshadowed the policy was like on day one, the kind of performative gestures he made on Title IX and trans inclusivity in college sports and things like this that made it seem to people that he wasn't working on their behalf. He was working on behalf of a kind of extreme activism that they didn't agree with.
Which is like bureaucratic capture rather than reflecting his actual personality and priorities, which,
right,
you know, is is of a different generation, to put it
more
fundamentally. So you think it's actually making clear statements, some of which may be symbolic, some of which may be policy oriented, but just to say, no, we are returning to a more consistent vision of liberalism, which is, you know, equal rights under law, individuality, absolutely, and not front loading everybody's group identity first, because that's actually not only a political distraction, but it's divisive. It reinforces a lot of the old things we are actively working to transcend.
Absolutely. It's hard for me to see you as a Democrat or as a fellow American or as anything other than a white man if I'm forced to constantly think of myself as fundamentally only through the lens of my racial identity, which is not the same as yours. We have to find a way to make as salient as possible that which we share and can share, and downplay as much as possible the immutable characteristics that divide us. Clearly. And there's a lot of ways that Democrats can signal that they're open to hearing the critique and that they're taking it seriously. I think that some people won't be able to be reached, but many Americans are looking for some self-reflection, some introspection. And the voices that are shouting, no, this is a white supremacist, fascist country, as Joy Reid did following the defeat, as many voices did, that's clearly not what most Americans want to hear. They don't want to hear that Donald Trump won an increasingly multicultural coalition through nothing but implacable white supremacy. They want some evidence that Democrats are able to understand that Americans of a variety of backgrounds can simply disagree with them. And we need to think about why that might be, that, you know, even with all of his evident flaws, his lying, his cheating, Donald Trump was still seen as somehow more appealing than the kind of status quo that had been offered to them. We must do some reflection on that, or I don't think we can convince people that we're the people that will fix the problems.
While also confronting the fact that the way he is governing does not reflect that sort of defender of free speech transcending all that divide, I mean, not even a little bit. And that's the opportunity to build a broader coalition based truly on a diverse liberal democracy, to put principles above party. And this goes back to fundamentals, right? Perfect's never on the menu. The goal is to form a more perfect union.
Right.
And the other most American idea, of course, is our national motto, E Pluribus Unum, out of many one. Moving more towards that. Thomas Chatterton Williams, thank you so much for joining us on How to Fix It. Always admire your work, and I look forward to seeing you down the road and talking again.
Thanks so much, John.